Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Health Today. We continue our visit to the University of Maryland's Center for Advanced Fetal Care. When we left you last, we were talking with Dr. Christopher Harmon, who's chief of the Center for Advanced Fetal Care, a place that's dedicated to the care of the unborn child and the family. It's one of the most advanced centers of its kind in the entire world. By testing and identifying fetal abnormalities as soon as possible, the center gives the baby and the mother a real opportunity for the most advanced care possible. Today we talk with Christina Broglie, who's about to receive a sonogram.
How far along are you?
I'm 20 weeks on Friday.
20 weeks. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's great. And so when I'm curious how you found about this particular place, this center. How did you end up here?
Well, my OBGYN said that I needed to go get a test for a nuchal translucency and suggested that I come get one done. And so I called it up and made an appointment. And so that's how I got here. Incredibly impressive how much that they can tell from looking at the baby through the sonogram and from all the different blood tests that they can do now. It's just wonderful because I feel like a lot of our concerns have been addressed with the fact that a lot of the tests that we've had have come back negative, meaning that's good.
Good.
Exactly. I think as any first-time mom would feel, is just anxious and nervous as to, is everything going to go right? Is my baby a perfect baby, or what is going to happen? Does it have something wrong with it, or how will it grow? And all of those concerns, I feel like, are slowly being answered, and I'm slowly being reassured that everything's fine and will be fine.
I'm going to get you positioned here for a moment. I'm going to put your head back, okay? I'll try and warn you. A little bit of gel there. So here's our little baby in here. See the little head down here at the bottom, maybe wiggling a little bit. There's the baby's heart beating. And I'm gonna hold still for just a minute. You can actually just see the baby moving around a little bit, little wiggles there. And there's a lot of different parts of the baby that you can see. You can see the little baby's head at the bottom. And see the heart beating. And we can actually hear the heart beating by using a tool we call Doppler. And you're gonna hear the pulse of the baby's heartbeat. And we can measure that heart rate, and today the heart rate's about 138, and that is in the normal range. And you can hear how nice and even it is. Baby moving.
That was the baby moving?
That was the baby moving that went from that nice even pulse to that big squiggle. That was a baby kicking around a little bit. Here's a little vein. That's a little vein that goes directly into the heart. And then we're going to get in the umbilical cord. So that's the artery in the cord. And of course, one of the funnest things to find out is if you're having a boy or a girl. And that's where you go down by between the legs, and depending on how the baby's positioned is how good of a look you get. And just like when they're born, you look between the legs to see what you got, that's exactly what we got to do. And I will agree that it is a girl.
Yay.
So, Mom, you were right. You called it. And then baby's going to turn up for us, and then we have a nice little profile there. Look, baby's even smiling at us a little bit. Look at that little smile, little mouth open. So those little feet crisscrossed down here. Baby's sitting with its ankles crossed. There's all little feet sticking up. See the toes?
Yeah.
And baby basically has everything it needs right now. All it needs to do is gain weight.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
How's it been for you?
It's been an interesting process. Being a first-time father, it's everything that I could ever hoped it would be. And everything, being able to share this whole experience with my wife so far has been a dream come true. And I know that as the process continues, it'll bring it, in a way, it's made us even, it's made our love even stronger for each other. So I know we'll grow even closer as a family and husband and wife in the future. So I've really enjoyed everything about the whole process so far.
For more information about UMMS's Center for Advanced Fetal Care, please call 410 828-3865 or log on to www.marylandfetalcare.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
Good afternoon. I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we welcome you to another Monday here on the air on the Mark Steiner Show with Anthony McCarthy and Mark Steiner to cover the important issues facing us in the day. We're at the end of this program. We will be talking with Maryland Republican gubernatorial candidate and former governor Robert Ehrlich for a bit. But we're going to spend the first chunk of our show, the first hour and a half of our show, talking about what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico, how it's going to affect the environment, how it's going to affect the economy, whether we can really get away from drilling oil or not. Many people argue we cannot.
Mark, the president of the United States flew in and spent a great deal, a considerable amount of time in Louisiana talking with some of the first responders and folks who are there on the ground. The White House releasing a statement earlier today saying that it's premature for them to talk about seriously changing their position on offshore drilling, But a lot of questions being raised right now.
And let me just, before, as we introduce our first guest here, the latest news is that the oil spill, some people are arguing now that it's 25,000 barrels a day, not 5,000 barrels a day, that 9 million gallons have already, may have already escaped from this underwater well, that in the explosion April 20th it killed 11 rig workers, one of whom was buried yesterday. The Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska seems to be dwarfed by what we're facing now. We're joined in the first part of our program by Stephen Peronin. Did I pronounce that right, Stephen?
Yes, that's correct.
Good. Stephen Peronin is executive director of the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana. And Richard Charter, who's a government relations consultant for the Defenders of Wildlife Action Fund and has worked with government officials and conservation organizations on offshore drilling issues for the past 30 years. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Give us, let me start with you, Stephen, and then go to Richard. And I'd like to get, you know, what the latest you've heard and what the assessment is of just how bad this really is, Stephen.
Well, this is a significant spill, no matter how you look at it. There have certainly been some discrepancies in reporting, starting with the earliest days of an estimated, 1,000 barrels a day, now up to 5,000 with estimates that could be as high as 20,000. We were at a significant spill that the day this incident occurred. So certainly we're more focused on the response at this point than necessarily quantifying what we're dealing with. I know that's going to be important for how we address some of the containment issues, but ultimately this was too much from day one.
Richard?
Well, first of all, you appropriately acknowledge the 11 families who lost their breadwinner
right.
in this accident. This is a human tragedy, first and foremost, and anyone who has had or has a family member that goes into harm's way every day to work knows they think about that every minute they're gone. So I want to
yes.
start with that because it is a human tragedy, and there are disagreements, obviously, about the volume of the flow rate. 3 days ago, it was upgraded from an estimate of 1,000 barrels a day to 5,000 barrels a day. There are calculations ongoing about the thickness of the spill and the geographic extent of the spill at this point, indicating that it could be a higher flow rate. But as the Coast Guard said this morning, there is really no way to tell when you're dealing with something that's 5,000 feet underwater. And it is a problem any flow rate you have if it continues into the future. In other words, the estimates for the quickest one could drill a relief well to intercept this uncontrolled flow of oil 5,000 feet under the ocean. The soonest we might get a relief well drilled to stop that flow is 2 to 3 months from now.
I want to ask you both, Stephen and Richard, about the initial response. This is Anthony McCarthy, by the way. The initial response from BP and even really the federal government when the explosion took place and we first started getting reports on the oil rig disaster was that this would be very easy to contain, that they were going to use drones to cap and cut off these wells. And then there was this talk of roping off, burning off, now this relief well. Give me your assessment. And I'm not asking you to, you know, be dramatic or anything along those lines, but a lot of people are very confused about how we went from those initial reports that this was serious, but we were going to cap this and contain this, to now where we're, you know, we heard the governor of Florida preparing folks in Florida for the repercussions of this spill. Stephen?
Well, my expertise is certainly not in the engineering aspect of drilling, but what I will speak to is the idea that certainly when you're dealing at these depths, 5,000 feet below the surface of the Gulf of Mexico and a well that extends beyond that from the ocean floor, almost 12,000 feet, that there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty and technical difficulty in evaluating the extent and the damage of this type of a situation. What we do know is that similar to what we see in the airline industry is there are a series of fail-safes that are put in place for this inherently type of risky activity. What we do know is that a number of them clearly failed. What we're unclear about is, were those safety mechanisms in their entirety adequate to address the risk of drilling at that depth and the potential of this well at its uncapped volume to release almost 150,000 barrels a day through production. So there's some serious questions about, are there appropriate safety mechanisms in place for deep water exploration where we may have an entirely different set of response mechanisms in place for the more shallow exploration opportunities that we engage in.
Richard?
I think that the initial response, which was search and rescue, obviously, to try to see if they could recover the missing individuals, was appropriate. I think that actually the response initially was based on BP's statement that there was no spill, that there would be no leakage of oil. That was the initial announcement. That is, I think, led to perhaps as much as a 24-hour delay in deployment and preparedness, but I don't think that's the problem. In other words, I believe that given the scale of this event, that we have about one-third of the chemical dispersant on the planet ready to go along the Gulf Coast. We have something like 1 million feet of boom in place, and you're seeing a lot of it just blown up on the beaches doing nothing because of the weather not cooperating. It is possible to create accidents that you can't turn off that are beyond human scale to clean up, and we may have one of those accidents. And I'm having a little trouble hearing Stephen, so if I'm redundant to his statements, that's
fine. That's good. If, let me see if we can do something on the other end to get those.
But I would suggest that appropriately now, since this is an emergency that is threatening the regional economy, if not the national economy, that we probably should collectively as a nation move beyond the blame game, you know, and let the investigations going forward in the next year or so take care of that and unify behind a call to shut off this leak. In other words, get the drilling rig in, start drilling the interception relief well, and do that as quickly and as safely as possible using every federal and private resource available, because that is the first thing we need to do.
There are two things that were just said in the last few minutes. I think let's take each one, and they're worth kind of exploring. One is, you just said a moment ago, Richard Charter, that this could be beyond the scope of man to clean up. We may just have created a disaster here that is among the worst. And so that's A. Let me start with that question for the both of you. What does that mean? I mean, what does that mean in terms of environmentally, what we face and what people face in that Gulf region? I read a short piece, very short piece, is coming on the air today, that was saying that the Gulf Stream could pick this up and take this down into the Keys. I mean, that this could expand even further, maybe not as devastatingly as it's going to do in Louisiana and Alabama, but clearly be there. So, Rich, let me start off with you, since you raised the issue first. I mean, what does that portend for us if that's the case?
Richard?
Oh, yeah. I would suggest that looking forward, it is very hard to project 2 days from now rather than 3 days from now or 2 weeks from now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the very forces that are causing this slick to be so difficult to contend with, you know, the geometrically expanding perimeter, the stretching for, you know, 180 miles or however long it was this morning, you know, that set of forces combined with the weather not cooperating, the wave state that's bringing the booms ashore without leaving them any protection at all along that coast, may interact in various ways with a function called the loop current, which is a very large, powerful, high-speed current that sweeps up from the south through the Gulf of Mexico and down the Gulf Coast of Florida. It stays some distance offshore, the Gulf Coast of Florida, but it would have the potential to carry pollution through the Keys and around the tip of Florida. Now, this particular oil is less viscous and less like tar than the Exxon Valdez spill, the Alaska North Slope crude oil. And so we're beginning to see that it may not travel as far in the warmer water and still be dangerous. So it's very uncertain predicting the future of this thing, but it is clear that it could go a very long way.
And Stephen, to talk about your conversations and the work you're doing with BP, and I mean, right now we see senators, three Democratic senators, who are trying to create a bill that says liability for companies like BP will rise from $75 million to $10 billion. So talk about what's going on in your conversations and what you think BP is doing.
Well, you know, I can't speak specifically to what BP is doing to cap the well at this point in time. I mean, there are a number of complex operations, from using underwater solvents to the idea of a dome to encapsulate some of the oil at the floor of the Gulf right now prior to its being emitted to the surface. I think that what you see right now in terms of the response posture for elevating BP's liability on this is some degree of a recognition of the potential impacts here. Certainly when you look at the various implications, specifically for coastal Louisiana, with a heavy reliance on fisheries, productivity of these wetland systems, significant economic value of that to the state. When you start to talk about the tourism industry along the Gulf Shore states like Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, I think you start to get a sense of the potential expense just in the damage to the economy, and that does not even begin to address the uncertainty right now that we have about the damage to the environment, depending on where and to the extent of the damage associated with the actual spill on the ecosystem. I think a couple of things that we've seen BP rush to the table for is to try and engage, at least in Louisiana, the commercial fishing industry. Right now, the entire eastern fishing grounds east of the Mississippi have been shut down for availability to fishermen. As a result, that has put a great deal of fear and uncertainty into the heart of many of the economy of those communities right now. And so BP has attempted to engage them through their Vessels of Opportunity program to assist in deploying boom. As Richard mentioned, that has been a very difficult exercise in over the past couple of days. If we've seen significant winds gusting up to 30 miles an hour, we've seen significant wave action that has certainly done a great deal of damage to that boom that's been deployed. So I think that they are attempting to contain it in its immediate sphere of influence near the Gulf. But as we see, as Richard referenced again, the loop current and the longshore drift beginning to potentially spread this to the east, I think the scope of impacts from the fisheries of Louisiana now to the tourism industry of these Gulf Coast states could be extremely larger than anything we anticipated in the first few days.
I'm Mark Steiner, and we're talking now with Steve Perronin, who is Executive Director of the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana, and Richard Charter, Government Relations Consultant for the Defenders of Wildlife Action Fund. They join me and Anthony McCarthy here during the first part of this program. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. And Mark in Hartford County, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
My first question is, you said earlier, don't blame anybody, but when does the federal government lie in the blame? Isn't this one of the things that we didn't want Obama to say, okay, allow all, drilling like this magnitude? Number two, you said that Congress, that a few of the congressmen were going to put together the kind of act to basically bill BP billions of dollars. But aren't who's going to pay for that bill in the long run? Isn't it going to be basically British Petroleum customers to pay for that? And same thing with the Fed. Aren't we going to have to put the bill for the federal in on that? And how do we prevent this in the future?
To take a series of questions there in order, to be fair, this particular drilling rig on this particular site was primarily a function of the Bush administration. The approvals, the green light, there were some safety documents that were reviewed and approved during 2009 by the Obama administration, but this project was well underway in the former administration. Now, it is true that President Obama, on the 31st of March of 2010, proudly announced that he was opening new areas to offshore drilling that included 3 miles from shore off of Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and the east coast of Florida, and coming much closer to the west coast of Florida with new drilling. And he also, at the same time, allowed Shell to move into the Arctic Ocean with this same type of exploratory drilling as early as this summer. In fact, we expect drilling like this to begin in the Arctic Ocean in a matter of a few weeks. So that timing of that announcement on the part of President Obama may have been unfortunate in light of this accident. Of course, he could not have predicted that this would occur, and he has said that those plans, with the exception of Shell drilling in the Arctic, the plans on the Mid and South Atlantic, at least, and the Florida Gulf Coast for nearshore drilling have been held in abeyance until the investigation concludes. As far as the liability increase, this bill that's being discussed to raise the liability limit from up to $10 billion from currently $75 million, that liability falls on the spiller. That falls on the oil and gas industry. The originator of the spill pays that money. So that's not taxpayer money. That simply means that this spill is likely to exceed the current cap of liability, and the senators are recognizing a need to increase that cap.
You have any comments on that, Steve, as well? Or do you?
Well, I think that is an accurate assessment in how responsibility is structured at this point in time, where the polluter pays. Effectively, this was a BP-operated rig. BP will bear the full cost of the cleanup. Of course, at this point in time, the federal government shares no cost responsibility and is assisting in the recovery efforts associated with that. The ultimate question is, what is the price tag at the end of the day? I think that has yet to be determined, and I think that the increase in the cap to $10 billion is a potential move to forecast the exact impact of what we could be looking at. At the same time, that I think when you look at the responsibility, clearly this is the accident is clearly BP's responsibility. I think we also have to look at the federal regulatory oversight that's put in place, and is it stringent enough? I'm not prepared to answer those questions, yes or no, but I think this certainly begs the question that we need to revisit those standards and ensure that when we are beginning to stretch the limits of our technology for exploration, that we are equally stretching the limits of our safety mechanisms that have to be in place if we're in fact going to allow this type of operation.
You going to say something, Anthony?
Well, I was just going to ask, earlier today, the Interior Secretary, Salazar, was very clear that the federal government, as far as oversight, was going to, in his words, keep their boot on the neck of BP, which caused a little stir in people saying that the language maybe was too strident. But it's clear that the Obama administration recognizes that there could be serious, no pun intended, blowback on this for the administration.
Well, I think one of the things that we'll jump into in the next hour here is the question is just what that blowback will be and what's going to happen in terms of oil drilling in the future, and can America do without oil drilling, and what does that mean, and the arguments that will kind of ensue because of this, and how the whole anti-corporate wave in America is also feeding into that. I do want to do something before we go to this break, and gentlemen, I wish you'd all just bear with me 1 minute. Because as we said, and you said, as I said in the beginning of this program, Richard Charter, you commented on that what we're talking about here, first and initially, are the men who died on that rig who are doing nothing more than attempting to make a living to pay for their lives and take care of their families. And we forget about that. And I want to read the names of the men who died on that rig. For all of us just to think about that, we'll do that again at the end of the hour and have their names and other information posted on our website as well, because that's something we cannot lose sight of. Jason Anderson, Aaron Dale Burkeen, Donald Clark, Stephen Curtis, Roy Wyatt Kemp, Carl Kleppinger, Gordon Jones, Blair Manuel, Dewey Rivet, Shane Rashto, and Adam Weiss all died on that rig, and I wanted to make sure that we remembered the men who died there and in the midst of all this, not to let the lives of those who we lost be forgotten. We're going to take a very brief break and come back to continue this discussion. Steve Pernine, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I do appreciate you taking time on the show with us today. Richard Charter, thank you. I know you're going to stay with us for a bit.
I am.
And we're going to come right back and be joined by Mike Olson, who is a counsel at Bracewell & Giuliani's Environmental Strategies Group in D.C. and worked in the Department of Interior under George W. Bush. And in a bit, John Hiskus will also join us, staff writer for grist.org. You can join us here, 410-319-8888. As we go to this break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of a heart center, go to www.umm.edu/heart. We'll be right back.